Mike Haynes joins us on Sports Byline USA as we continue talking to the Hall of Fame defensive back. You're a kid that grew up in Southern California. You went to college in Arizona. How did you deal with the winters in New England?
Well, it was a slow start. I had never seen snow come down before. Living in Southern California, the mountains are close enough where you could, in 2 hours from L.A., be up at Big Bear and play in the snow and do things up there. But I had actually never seen snow come down. Definitely had never driven in snow. And it was, I got so many funny stories of not only almost killing myself, because I didn't know exactly how to drive in the snow, but, also in practice. I couldn't believe that we were practicing in the snow. You couldn't see the field. But it didn't change much. We would throw on these heavier jackets and run around. You couldn't tell who was who, but you'd get the recognition in on the plays that the opponent is going to run, and I guess that was the most important thing.
What did corrections did you have to make to deal with the weather elements?
Well, one, I had to learn how to drive in it, because if I was going to get to work, I knew I had to get there somehow, and so I'd leave a lot earlier, and I'd drive a lot slower. Some of the guys that grew up in the Northeast helped me out a little bit about things I need to be worried about, like black ice and hitting the brakes too hard, and spinning out, and what to do, if the car is spinning one way and everything. So, there were quite a few things, but the most important thing was just not to drive too fast and just to go, as slow as I felt I needed to go to be safe.
What about playing-wise?
Well, playing-wise was very difficult, trying to stay warm. I mean, I wasn't alone in that, I guess. There were a lot of guys concerned and doing different things there. Guys were wearing stockings underneath, pantyhose, I should say, to try and keep the heat in and layered clothing and different things like that. My weight as a player stripped was about 198, but on some days I was probably 208, running around with this stuff on just to try and stay warm. When you're in the game, of course, it's a lot easier. You're moving around, but if the offense is out there and they have a long drive and then there's a timeout or whatever, you could be on the sideline for 10, 12 minutes and pretty cold. It's pretty tough to warm back up and get back in there and play, with vigor. You're just focused on the cold almost instead of focused on the game.
I wonder whether the Pats did something in talking to the Minnesota Vikings when they played at Metropolitan Stadium, and you probably remember that stadium. It was just as cold as heck. In the wintertime, they used to tell me that when Miami came into town to play them or San Diego or any of the teams from the warm weather cities, that they would come out and warm up with short sleeve shirts on. And they would
just... We used to do the same thing when we play Miami and it kind of backfired on us when we played the Houston Oilers in a playoff game, though. They did it. It was freezing cold and we thought we had an advantage. When they came out for warm-ups, the guys had on short sleeve shirts. I'm going, oh my gosh, these guys are what did they do? How could they be used to this? But they upset us. They beat us that game. So it was a good tactic, and I guess a little bit of psychology worked.
Over the years, Mike, in talking to NFL players, I have found in talking to wide receivers, talking to running backs, talking to linemen, they all have a different personality that really fits the position that they play. So having said that as a prelude, what, generally speaking, do you think is the personality of a defensive back and also a punt returner?
Well, I used to be a wide receiver and wanted to be a wide receiver. That's really what I wanted to play. And I think the difference is a wide receiver, when he catches the ball, for the most part, he's expecting to get hit and expecting to get hit hard. So when he catches the ball, he'll just jump up, throw the ball to the official and run back and get in the huddle. Most guys who I think are on defense wouldn't do that. They would get hit hard. They'd probably throw the ball down at the ground and try to push the guy who just hit him or throw the ball at the guy who just hit him. You know, their temperament is a little bit different, and they want to get even right away. And I think that's a huge, huge difference in the personalities. Defensive backs, they don't like to get beat. They don't like looking bad. And they want to get to the next play as quickly as they can so they can get even. Where receivers are a little bit more calm, they expect to get hit like that. They know that the game is just starting. They're going to have to get hit about five or six more times before the end of the day. You know, they're just, their mentality is a little bit different with regard to it.
How do
as a punt returner, I think it's just an opportunity to, you know, run with the ball and just, you know, do something exciting and try to get to the end zone. I think there's really no difference with regard to that. Both defensive players and offensive players probably feel the same way about the opportunity to run with the ball.
How do defensive backs, how are they different today in playing that position because of the rule changes? I know Jack Tatum once told me, he said, anybody that came into my area, I clothesline. Well, that was legal back when Jack was playing at that time.
Yeah.
But now, of course, that's different. You got a 5-yard cushion. You can't touch them, put your hands on them and everything. Has that changed some way, not just the physicality of playing as a defensive back, but also the mental approach as well?
Well, those rules changed. I guess I was in my second year, and They're pretty much standard, and they might call it a little bit more often and focus on it a little bit differently than they did when I played. My rookie year, you could hit the guy as often as you wanted as long as the ball wasn't in the air. But I guess in my second or third year with the rule change, it became a little bit more difficult to cover guys. And I really wondered if I'd be able to cover the world-class sprinter, you know. But fortunately, working out with world-class sprinters kind of helped me, and I didn't feel as much anxiety as probably a lot of other guys who didn't run track. So I don't know. I think that today the rules, they really benefit a big guy, the wide receiver now playing for the Detroit Lions, Megatron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, and you take a guy like, say, LeBron James in basketball, he would be a superstar in football, I believe, because of his athletic ability, his ability to jump, and you wouldn't be able to cover him. I mean, the probably the toughest guy for me to cover, and when I say that, I don't mean that the others weren't tough to cover, but he was tougher because of his height, and it was Harold Carmichael, and he was built like a basketball player, and I think that, a team who really wanted to do some damage passing the ball, they would have several guys on their offense that are, basketball type players instead of the short, super quick guys, because the taller guy can just by being with his height and being in a certain position, he's open. You know, just throw it high, just throw it outside. And if he's a super gifted guy, can catch the ball with one hand, he's going to be an awesome target for most of the day.
After 7 years with the Patriots, 28 interceptions, and having your number later retired by the Patriots, I'm still trying to figure out how you got with the Raiders, because the information I read says you played out your option with the Pats in 82, and in November of 1983, your contract was awarded to the Los Angeles Raiders in a settlement that gave the Patriots a number one draft choice in 84 and a number two pick in 85, and after playing the last 5 regular season games, you started in the Raiders Super Bowl victory. And you had one interception in that one. Explain that a little bit further to me.
Well, I think that growing up in Los Angeles, or growing up in the time that I grew up also, that I was really influenced by a lot of the civil rights leaders and the different things that you had to do for change. And sometimes you have to sacrifice maybe yourself or a season. And in my situation, I had played out my option, and so... the only thing I could do, if I wasn't going to sign with the Patriots, I had to retire because there was no free agency. But the day of the deadline, Al Davis, I knew that the Patriots and Raiders were in discussion of a trade, and Pat Sullivan called me and said, Mike, I'm sorry, we weren't able to trade you. The deadline passed, and we weren't able to get the deal done. And then shortly after that, Al Davis called and said, Mike, we were able to do it. I said, I just got the phone, Pat. He said, you guys didn't. And so when I called my attorney, he says, get on the plane, come on out to Los Angeles. And for me, L.A. was home for me. That's where the Raiders were playing at that time. So So I ended up, the decision ended up going to court, and never really got to court because when we were in discussion with the court about the case, the judge wanted to hear the case, but there was since it was involving a lot of antitrust laws, there would have been a lot of information about the NFL that would have been uncovered that they didn't want to have uncovered, and so they settled out of court. So I'm technically the first free agent. I was almost like the Curt Flood of baseball for football. But because the case really never went to court, not a lot of people know about it. And so the Raiders gave up a first and a second round draft choice to the Patriots, and I got a chance to come play in Los Angeles.
I'm glad it didn't turn out the same way the Curt Flood situation turned out in baseball. When you go to the Raiders, you have a teammate there, Lester Hayes, and the two of you were named the best cornerback tandem in NFL history by the NFL Network. Now, I'll share a quick story about Lester. I was a sportscaster on television in San Francisco at that time, and I remember doing an interview with Lester, but it was one of the first interviews I did with the Raiders, but I did not know that he stuttered. And so when he went to answer the questions, he stuttered, but I went through about 5 minutes and just kept going. And then in later years, I came across him, and he said, I want to tell you something. He said, I want to tell you thank you. And I said, for what? He said, because you didn't embarrass me. And that's something that stays with me to this day. He was a hell of a football player, and you two together were incredible.
He was one of the smartest players I've ever played with. And you know, when I joined the Raiders, you know, I'd already played seven seasons. And had, five, six different position coaches, you know, and each one of them an expert at something, either zone or man-to-man or a certain type of zone or a certain type of man-to-man. And when I joined the Raiders, I did not realize how much I still had to learn. But, you know, going there with having Willie Brown as a secondary coach and another guy also whose name is, we just called him Skin, first name was Jimmy. Those two guys I learned an awful lot from. But when I actually had time to study with Lester, I learned so much I can't even tell you. One, you know, being in the AFC West, they had all the teams in AFC West had great quarterbacks and great receivers with John Elway and, you know, Dan Fouts and, you know, all these Hall of Fame guys, you know, and tough receivers. Well, I don't know that I would have been able to have the success I had right off the bat if not for Lester. Football was his life. It was what he knew best. And he could get me up to speed on all the quarterbacks and all the receivers in one setting. So we're going to play the Denver Broncos. We sit down and watch them together. And he already knew exactly what kind of plays they would run, what they would do, what the quarterback loved to do, what he hated to do, and, you know, what made him special. And so, you know, generally you would have to put in an awful lot of time to learn those kinds of things. But Lester didn't mind sharing, and it helped me out a lot. And as a result of it, we had some great years together.
We only have a couple minutes left, but when you think back on your storied Hall of Fame career, is there a particular moment that's ingrained in your mind, Mike, that you'll never forget?
I think it's the Super Bowl, playing in Super Bowl. No question, actually. Now, you know, it is a Super Bowl. It's what I play for every single year, and I wished I could have played in more. I'm jealous of the guys who got a chance to play in more Super Bowls. I know how difficult it is to get there every year, and the one that we did have and that I got to play in was a special one. I got it. You know, my whole family was there. It was a special moment, you know, playing with Marcus Allen and that great run that he had. You know, my family and his family are connected. You know, my mom and his dad grew up together. And so it was a special time in Raider history. And I'm just fortunate that I was able to be there and be part of it. So many great players. And most importantly, I got a chance to do with Al Davis, who I think wanted to have on his tombstone, greatest owner of all time.
Mike, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's good to reminisce about your career. You deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. You had an outstanding 14-year career. Please come back and join me again here on Sports Byline.
Thank you, Ryan. I'd love to do that.
NFL Hall of Fame defensive back Mike Haynes, also inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline.